So I'm just kind of giving an overview here of just a sampling of some recent stuff that's come up in just the general topic of ULVZs and partial melting and the deep mantle. I'm not really going over things in detail. Just more of a sampler, kind of like what's the recent things that have come out and where are things going in the near future. So very much trying to capture some of the cutting edge. So I might skip over a lot of this stuff that I put in here, but there's a lot of things to talk about when it comes to this topic. There's been a lot of different work from different areas, but so there's the thing. I'll just briefly discuss the detection and characterization and interpretation of ultra-low velocity zones. I'll talk about some dynamical issues, their stability, the retention of melt. How can these things keep melt in this scenario? Alan kind of covered the location in relation to larger scale mantle structures, so I'll probably gloss that over. And evolution scenarios, where these things come from, what does it mean for the evolution of the Earth, actually, if there's partial melt at the bottom of the mantle. And relationship to Earth's core is something that's coming up, and I'll briefly talk about that. So essentially this is an image from Eddie Garnero and Michael Thorne did a paper in this Encyclopedia of Geomagnetism, I think it was called. And there's different phases that people have used seismic waves to try and probe the core mantle boundary and look at small scale structures. This is all short period stuff, by the way. There's SCP. Actually, Sebastian Rost has done some really good work with this phase. Basically, it's a downgoing S phase, which comes back up as a P reflection, and you get precursors and stuff on any ULVZ type structures down there. Things like that. There's PCP, which is just a straight downgoing P, reflects off the core mantle boundary, comes up. You can also use precursory information, maybe reverberations, things like that. All these things are hopefully coming up on a seismogram when you plot them up. If there's a structure here, say, there's the PCP pulse coming back from that reflection. If there's a reflection above it, you'll get like a little precursory pulse, and the same with all these other SCP type of things. PKP is something that goes into the core and then back out, and you can get precursors there as well. Then there's this SPDKS, which has been used a lot by Eddie Garnero and Michael Thorne to try and map these things out. These are actually downgoing S waves, which then have a diffracted leg along the core mantle boundary, and they kind of sample along a big path, and then they go into the core and then back out. But this is like something that's a diffracted phase along the CMB that actually has some of the better coverage of all the phases at the CMB. So this is where all this information is kind of coming from. There's a lot of different things going on. Michael Thorne used this SPDKS phase to try and map out the likelihood that ULVZ exists in one place or another, and came up with maps like this one. The white spots here are like kind of no data. So my comment to Alan about like how well do we seismologically know where ULVZ are and are not is, you know, this is like the best case scenario. It's actually, this is also a very optimistic point of view, because if you were to go to a review paper by Thorne Lay in 2004, where he kind of says this is where we believe there's been ULVZ detections, you'll find that he's got places circled under Africa, say, that aren't showing up in this analysis at all. So it's still something that's being worked out.
That's on the basis of what?
Basically what...
Force of ULVZ or...
No, this is actually based solely on SPDKS. And so that's why the coverage is kind of shoddy. You've got basically the only places where he can actually compute a likelihood is where there's crossing paths. And that's not very many places for this phase.
Plus there's, I think, some Fresnel zone consideration.
There's definitely Fresnel zone consideration.
Not the exact sampling.
That's right.
Fresnel zone assumption is valid.
That's right, and that's laterally as well as vertically. When you have a diffractive phase, the kind of you're looking at an integral of seismic velocity up from the CMB that kind of tails off exponentially. But this is just kind of preliminary stuff. But this is kind of the best you can do with that. And there's a lot of places that aren't really well covered. And I think it's a good point to make that we don't really know how if the ULVZ is more ubiquitous or less ubiquitous. We find them in a few places. Some places we don't see them. There's a place actually right underneath California that John Vidalia has looked at. It's like the waves come off of that are just like clean. They don't seem to be anything there. They published a paper on that back in the 90s. The big deal is that the change in S-wave velocity relative to P-wave velocity seems to be in a ratio of about 3 to 1. It's typically found for a lot of the studies that have been done where they can get information derived from S and P. The magnitude is very large too. Not to be lost in just the ratio is the fact that it's the change in VS has been measured up to something like -30%, which is enormous for kind of a mantle relative to normal mantle variations. And then the VP would of order -10%, very typical. There are recent findings, though, of some spots of places that have actually been studied before where, and this is Alex Hutko, a Thorne Lace student who just recently graduated, was looking at this. He went back and he looked at some of the stuff, and he was looking at VS and VP jumps and kind of what he could fit with his data, and he was actually doing some deconvolution stuff. It's kind of tricky modeling and inversion, but they're finding stuff that can be consistent with a 1-to-1 ratio as well. So if true, that would mean that ULVZ stuff at the bottom of the mantle is not always in the 3-to-1 ratio. It seems to be laterally heterogeneous. And the best analogy for that is probably something like Earth's crust at the top of the Earth, where the seismic velocity in Earth's crust also changes dramatically from one place to another. It's partly molten in one place and frozen in another, etc. So it's a non-uniform kind of thing. So the other thing is that, you know, dynamically, of course, we know that these have to be dense features because they are, they're at the bottom of the mantle. They have very low topography, the kind of pillbox kind of nature of these things. Their aspect ratios suggest that they have high density. You can also get this from seismology. This is a study done by Sebastian Rost using the SCP that I showed earlier. And essentially, he's modeling the precursors here. And he's putting in different values for the depth or the thickness of the ULVZ structure, the P-wave velocity, and the S-wave velocity changes. And in this one, what he's doing is he's changing. So this is the best fitting S and P and depth that he gets from the model. Here he's varying the density difference. And you see as you go from positive density to negative density, what's happening here, what the thing to notice is out here at the precursors, is that it's actually changing phase, and it becomes opposite to the data as you go from there. So the better fits to these precursors is when you have a denser ULVZ structure in there. So it's a really nice kind of thing that he's done.
Explanation why this large swing misses everything?
This stuff over here, yes, that's in the reverberation. So what he has to do actually to fit that is put gradients inside the ULVZ. But and he actually did that in his paper and fit that, but he uses the caveat that stuff in the coda can come from anywhere, out of plane, et cetera, precursory stuff is a little bit more robust. But that's what you have to do. You have to put gradients inside the ULVZ to fit that. There's still a lot of trade-offs in the interpretations and in some of the ways these things are probed. There was kind of a zoology that was starting to develop around structures at the CMB with Ray Jeanlow and Eddie Garnero. There's like ULVZ, there's core rigidity zones, core mantle transition zones, there's fuzzy CMB. There was like all this stuff coming around. You know, it just kind of reflects, I think, the diversity of observations that you get at the CMB. They're not always the same. On the question of whether something is on the core or mantle side is really a question of its density. If it's closer to density of the core, then it's on the core side. If it's closer to the density of the mantle, it's on the mantle side. It's just an isostatic kind of simple consideration you can make. So here's like a cartoon that Eddie made. Basically, he's got ULBZ, fuzzy CMB, and sediments. Sediments are something that Bruce Buffett proposed a while back. Is that so silicates are soluble to some extent in molten iron, and if you were to run that to saturation, allow the outer core to saturate, and then cool it down, then actually it would be supersaturated, and you get silicates and silicon and oxygen and stuff like that coming back out of the core over time, maybe producing sediments. And so Bruce was proposing that actually to explain decadal variations in the length of the day, to have a magnetic coupling between the core and the mantle. I'll talk a little bit more about that kind of stuff later. And actually, you know, as if this weren't enough, we have now Wendy Mao did some experiments where she put iron, a lot of iron, in post-perovskite, and iron stabilizes post-perovskite, according to her. And she's able to get kind of seismic velocity changes that are consistent if you have iron-rich post-perovskites next to ordinary mantle. The problem is that, I guess, her experiments were done at lower temperatures than the CMB, and if you were to heat her samples up to CMB temperatures, then you'd probably melt the stuff anyway. So it's kind of, again, you get back to the thing that's, it can also contribute, but everything's just kind of mixed together. There's a mixture of different effects and influences that we might expect. Melting temperatures are interesting. Of course, we like to know what the solidus of the mantle is all the way down to the core mantle boundary, but we do not. What we do know is a little bit about the melting curves of some individual phases. Some of these are actually no longer believed anymore. A lot has changed in this area, but this is a paper that Zier and Bowler came out with this in 98. Essentially, these are Diamond Anvil cell experiments done up to 60 GPA. The way they detected melt in their experiments is they use a laser heating type of thing. And as soon as melt started to form the experiment, there's kind of a laser coupling instability that happens that causes wild fluctuations in the radiation and stuff like that. So they were able to measure stuff up to about 60 GPA. The exact numbers are still kind of debated in terms of like the precise measurement. But anyways, if you extrapolate this up to the CMB using kind of magnesium woustite as like your most easily melted major phase, then you get solidus temperatures that are right around the core, expected range of core temperatures. And you know, you could put very large error bars on all of this stuff, but it's not unreasonable that things are at least close to that. It motivated me actually to look at what would happen if the mantle solidus were less than the CMB temperature. And so I did some convection studies when I was a grad student along these lines, and I won't bore you with the details of the models, but these frames, the top one is a temperature frame, the bottom one is a frame showing the melt fraction. And what I've changed here is the solidus temperature. So this is the lowest solidus temperature here, and this is the highest one. The units are such that a temperature of 1 is the core mantle boundary, so this solidus is always less than the core mantle boundary in this, so you get melt forming at the bottom. And then on the left here, these are effective buoyancy numbers, so the thing to know is that the stuff over here, down here, is dense melt, the stuff up here is light melt. This is a neutrally buoyant melt here. What I found, of course, is that if the melt is buoyant or neutrally dense or even not quite dense enough, that you tend to get melt in these vertical tendrils and stuff like that. Very un-ULBZ-like, and probably you wouldn't even detect these things seismologically, especially with diffractive phases going along the core metal boundary. It'd be harder to detect these than a plume roots. Well, I guess these are plume roots, but it'd be the same kind of type of thing. You get wider aspect ratio features when the melt is dense, as you would expect. The buoyancy of the melt is able to overcome the thermal buoyancy instead of enhancing it, and it kind of stabilizes things out. So it looks kind of okay, but this is batch melting, right? I've not done anything but just kind of let the metal melt. The solidus here is pressure independent because the pressure changes are very small over the bottom. On the order of 10 kilometers, the pressure of the solidus is not. I should mention that the length scale here, the vertical length scale, is 500 kilometers or so. So these are very thin structures, and the solidus is expected to flatten out and maybe even invert in the deep mantle because melt is compressible, and so the volume change goes the opposite way, and that shifts the reaction over towards the, you know. Oh yeah, that's a fun thing. So I impose actually, so I have a permeable boundary condition which allows material to flow in and out. The only thing I impose other than that is a Gaussian temperature anomaly, which is the slab, and then I make it does a random walk to induce some time dependence in the flow, and that's all I do. And so the boundary layer forms self-consistently and whatnot, and so I'm not imposing much else than that. I'm sorry. Oh, they're just it's permeable. It's zero radial or vertical gradients. Yeah. So if material. Yeah, material is typically flowing out in other places, so it doesn't really matter what the temperature is. If it's flowing in, then I take the average of the temperatures around it. It's kind of a tricky business, but I found that once it gets going, it doesn't really matter because all this stuff is going out and that stuff's going in. So if I add a melt percolation though to this, right? That was just batch melting. I won't belabor this point, but this is like a melt retention number, and this is a buoyancy number again, and the density is increasing down here. I found out the melt drains out really fast if there's a density difference and between that and the solid, and it's not really showing up here on this projector for some reason, but should be like a gray box over here. And this is a melt retention number here. Basically, the rate of percolation increases in this direction to the left and decreases over here. And I put a gray box over here showing that this is like the usual range of physical parameters that you would expect. And it's orders and orders of magnitude away from anything that retains melt. And that's a really big problem. People have pointed this out before. Dave Stevenson is always talking about it, that if you estimate the time it takes for the solid to compact and melt to kind of drain out, then these partially molten features shouldn't actually be very long-lived, and they should separate. They should be able to compact. So let me just say that this is an ongoing topic of research. Mark Jelinek and I have a paper that will be coming. We'll submit very soon on this. We found out that if you allow for internal circulation inside of the ULVZ and also compaction forces and other things like that. And of course, Sosh talked about this before. You can have surface forces and things like that, that you can actually retain melt a lot more easily. So some of this problem seems to go away a little bit. Alan kind of covered this. You know, if you have dense thermochemical piles that kind of they modify the flow structure along the CMB, and these things are just like crust, right? You get thick crust where you have convergent tectonics. Tibet, Bolivia, there's Tibet and there's Bolivia there. The ULVZ are the same kind of thing. Actually, it's kind of fun to think about if continents had a low viscosity. They don't, but if they did, and they were allowed to circulate, you would actually get this kind of circulation in the continent. You'd get upwelling in the middle of the continent, and the edges of the continents would be circulating downward with the subduction flow. So it's kind of like inverted tectonics, except with a low viscosity boundary layer. A lot was made about, Alan didn't really discuss this so much, but about whether hotspots could be correlated with low velocities or seismic velocity gradients, and or maybe a mixture of the two. And so Michael Thorne played with this back when he was a grad student, and he could find some pretty good correlation between hotspot locations and a mixture of low S-wave velocity and gradient of S-wave velocity. You believe the largest gradients in S-wave velocity are going to be on the edges of the low velocity regions, as they ought to be, shown here, then it kind of conforms well with the general idea that hotspots are arising from deep-seated mantle plumes. These things are rooted at convergent zones at the CMB, where ULVZ would also be accumulated. And so there is kind of a large picture that can develop out of this, but it's not been really established to anybody's total satisfaction yet. So, you know, what's the relationship to the ocean island basalt chemistry? Sampling the deep mantle should show signs of fractionation. Noble gas signatures depend on how the things are partitioning down there, parent isotope species, whether there's been past fractionation events. I'm not going to talk about this too much. One of the things that I've been kind of playing with is that you can explain there's an elevation in iron manganese ratio in ocean island basalts relative to MORB, which you cannot explain in terms of shallower melting processes. Manganese and iron tend to behave almost precisely the same, and you can't fractionate them away from each other. But in the deep mantle, you've got a high to low spin transition of iron, and that changes the partition coefficients such that you can then have fractionation of iron from manganese, even just by a slightly greater degree would allow you to create this signature by having a deep mantle fractionation event. Try and keep this. So the basal magma ocean is something that most of you might have heard of. Basically, here's the present picture. Maybe we have these chemical piles and stuff like that. We've got these ULVZ melt patches in certain spots. It seems to be melted. If that's the case, then we go back in time. The temperature increases back to Earth's formation. That melt layer only gets bigger and bigger and bigger. How does this melt stay down here? Why is it stable even? There's three lines of evidence that support that melts in the deep mantle are denser than the solid silicates in equilibrium. None of them are smoking gun, but there's at least three kind of lines of evidence that are consistent. The first and probably most dubious is from lower pressure experiments done in a multi-anvil cell up to about 30 GPa, and then taking the equation of state of melt and extrapolating that all the way up to 136 GPa. And then you find that the melts kind of become denser than the solids at some point. Another one is doing ab initio or you know, molecular dynamics models. Lars Stixrud has done a lot of these calculations where he finds that the structure of silicate melt is becoming more and more dense because it's very compressible, such that the molar volume difference between melt and solid are almost negligible at CMB conditions. Then all you'd have to do is add a little more iron in the melt than in the solid, which is typically the case, and you'd have a denser melt. Then there's shockwave experiments. Tom Marin's group has done a lot of these experiments where they claim to see dense melting, and he's had several students work on that as they went through, and they've also worked on other things too that are interesting, like they find the high Grunheisen parameter for liquids at high pressures, which is theoretically expected to occur, but they kind of put some new bounds on that. But anyways, that's that density of the melt keeps it stable. So if this is true, then we, this started way back at the beginning of the earth. And perhaps it was the segregation, the gravitational potential energy release by core formation or something along those lines, or maybe large impacts that heated up the bottom mantle to its initial temperature, and then the system started to cool down from there. The layer of magma would have to cool with the core, and so it has a very large effective heat capacity. The whole system has a large thermal inertia. And it cools very slowly, of course, by mantle convection. That's not a very efficient way to lose heat. So it's around for a little while, but when we did some models putting in kind of order of magnitude parameters, we find that this layer mostly cools and becomes pretty thin within the first billion years of Earth's history, and then it's a very thin layer after that. That could have some implications for like the initial temperature of the Earth. If you have the basal magma ocean here, the isentropic gradient is steeper probably than the liquid is because the volume differences involved for freezing are very small, whereas the Grunheisen parameter is very large. So you have this kind of scenario where the core is on the same isentrope as that in the basal magma ocean. You don't support any boundary layer between these because they're very low viscosity. And then there's at some point it starts to freeze up at the top here, and this is the base of the solid mantle. You probably can't get things much hotter than having it go right up to the liquidus everywhere. If it were higher temperature than that, it would cool very rapidly probably. The heat would directly be transported to the surface and probably radiated off into space over million year time scales. So probably somewhere around here we can kind of say if the whole mantle melted as a result of a giant impact or something like that, then we kind of know where the temperature starts from, at least from a theoretical point of view. We don't have very firm constraints on the liquidus temperature.
Probably doesn't matter. Why do those two isentropes connect without a thermal boundary layer?
No, there's a thermal boundary layer in there, but it's of order like a tenth of a Kelvin or so. So it's not resolved in this scale. So you can. That's right. The silicon melt has a high Grunheisen parameter, which increases actually with depth, and so it increases the isentropic gradient. The one in the core, actually, the Grunheisen parameter has kind of been better constrained recently by ab initio studies, if you agree with those results. So yeah, you would have this kind of relationship maybe. I mean, it's more schematic than anything else. Because the absolute values of things are not known, I can't put numbers on this axis and say this is what it is, and that would be dangerous to do anyways. But there's another thing. If we wanted to start off the Earth, we wanted to have a place to put a bunch of incompatible heat-producing elements, things like this missing reservoir, then we can make the initial thickness about 1,000 kilometers, and it would then fractionally crystallize over time. The crystallization would be almost perfectly fractional because stuff comes up to the top, say, in this magma ocean, starts to freeze. If it's a crystal and it gets entrained back downward, then it'll melt right back again. And that's because of this high isentropic gradient relative to the liquidus. So you can have a fractional crystallization, which then all these incompatible elements fractionate into the magma ocean and kind of stay there. They'd be in the ULVZ today. This is for the geophysicists in the audience. But the liquidus temperature, kind of initially here, will start crystallizing out some solid here. This is kind of a solid solution example of what a fractional crystallization would do. As you cool the system down and you freeze it out, of course, the time goes down, follows down the liquidus here. The melt becomes progressively enriched in composition alpha, which has the lower melting temperature. The thing to be thinking about here is that this is probably in the iron-rich side of things, and this is in the magnesium-rich side of things in terms of the bulk chemistry. Also, the solid becomes enriched the solid that's crystallizing out of this layer as it cools over time becomes enriched in iron and things like that. I'm going to skip that because it's a story in flux. So we can do, like, we can also say what this means for the thermal evolution of the Earth, calculate the effect that having a deep magma layer would have. So one of the things that people were worried about before is that to power the dynamo by thermal convection, for all of the known history that we've had a geomagnetic field, requires a very large heat flux at the CMB at the present day, or total heat flow, I should say. Recent estimates of heat flow at the CMB and kind of from different types of approaches are also showing pretty high heat flow at the present day. It means that you go back in the past and you end up melting the mantle. That's kind of the whole argument. But previously, people didn't want to melt the bottom of the mantle. They were trying to avoid doing that. And that's where some of the paradoxes kind of arise from. Now that it's okay to melt the bottom of the mantle, we don't care about that. That kind of problem goes away. However, early in the Earth's history, when there's a lot of melt down at the bottom of the mantle, then, so this is a thermal evolution model where we allow the mantle convection to remove kind of a steadily decreasing amount of heat from the deep mantle. Not only do we have to cool down the layer and crystallize it as well as the core, but there's a big latent heat component that tends to buffer the cooling and slows it down over time. So what we find then is actually the rate of which the core is cooling, it increases into the past a little bit, but then it decreases again as the effect of latent heat becomes more and more important into the past. And then it goes below the value of about 5 terawatts, at which you're not removing more heat out of the core than the waste heat, which is conducted down the adiabat. And so it makes it difficult to nucleate downwellings and things like that would drive thermal convection in the core and make a thermally driven dynamo. So we still run into the problem of not being able to have a dynamo in this case, but it's moved back to like the first 1 billion years of the Earth. The earliest kind of measurements of a magnetic field is around 3 or so. So there's some wiggle room in there. We could tell actually if there was a big magma layer at the bottom of the mantle. We could actually disprove it if we could find a really, really old sample with a strong geomagnetic preserved signal. So, oh yeah, just to kind of address Adam's earlier comment. If the crystals evolving from this progressively more and more enriched layers that fractionally crystallizes become denser and denser and denser with time, they become more and more iron enriched, then these piles can actually have formed in the middle of Earth history as the latest stuff to have crystallized out of it, rather than forming at the very beginning of Earth history. So there could be a genetic relationship between the melt and these structures to some extent. So I don't have much time left. ULVZ and melting at the bottom of the mantle are very important for core mantle coupling, not only for the implications of like the thermal processes and the energetics going on, but also with respect to chemical interactions. As Kanadi was talking about earlier, you can stick perovskite and post-perovskite at the bottom and kind of get some estimates of the equilibrium values, but then, as Uli pointed out, if you have silicate melt at the bottom of the mantle, it changes things quite a bit. Silicates can store a lot of incompatible species by definition, and that could alter the equilibrium with the core. There's actually some new stuff that's come up.
One of the arguments you made earlier to argue that melts are more dense is that they're much more compressible. And we
right.
think of things being incompatible on melts at low pressures because the structure is more open, they're less dense. So there are places to put your big ions, your incompatible elements.
Yeah.
Shouldn't the
yeah.
opposite be true at high pressure if your melt is more dense?
I think there's two effects that make things more incompatible in melts, or more compatible in melts than solids. One is that it's a statistical structure. You can find a gap appearing and then disappearing in the melt structure. And if you shove something into that little hole there, then it'll be there, and it can jump around between different holes that are forming and disappearing all the time. So there's also that kind of entropic kind of, you know, it doesn't have to occupy a site in a lattice anymore. It's kind of, it can jump around and find kind of holes and be compatible, even if there's no volume effect that would alter that. So, you know, but to predict it accurately is really tough to do, I think, because of that. And,
did anyone measure partition coefficient? I mean, not what they call metal boundary pressures, obviously.
Right.
Mainly, shrinking of density differences also occurs at more moderate pressures. We can do measurements.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the systematic trend, that's, I mean, they're not known very well. But there's some relative variations, I think we can believe, which is that iron is still relatively incompatible to magnesium. Things that are magnesium N members are melting at higher temperatures always than things that are iron N members. So that itself tells you that iron is more compatible in the melt.
What about large ion lithophiles?
Just the oxides and things like that, but I mean the experiments, the direct partitioning experiments on silicate like perovskite and things like that haven't really been done. So, there's some new experimental results. I think I'll just kind of leave with this. I mentioned this the other day, actually last week. That so Elise Niddle and Ray Janlow did some really cool experiments. Long time ago, well, not that long ago, but like a decade or so ago, showing that if you take a iron bearing perovskite and you stick it next to liquid iron and let them equilibrate, that a lot of the iron is sucked out of the perovskite, leaving it iron free, and it's taking silicon and oxygen with it. And the experiments they did were, I don't know, around, I think, of order 50 GPA. And then to apply it to the core mantle boundary, they have to extrapolate up. The biggest uncertainty in extrapolating this has been the solubility of oxygen in the core material. And it all boils down essentially to the volume the volume change involved, which has been highly controversial over time, which turns out to be as a consequence of misunderstandings of the phase diagram at lower pressures. I think this figure kind of summarizes what people were thinking before. So KD is actually the partition, the distribution coefficient, actually. So it's the higher it is, the greater the solubility of oxygen in iron. It was thought, this is Ruby et al., in an older study, that oxygen solubility could decrease with increasing pressure, but there was other people in other areas that thought it was the opposite. So recently, the experiments have actually been done up to CMB pressures to calibrate this. Also, the behavior of the lower pressure part of the phase diagram has been resolved. And they find that the change in the solubility with pressure is not that drastic, but still, if you add the temperature effect, it's very large, such that, so the CMB is up around here somewhere, 4,000 Kelvin-ish, oxygen is actually very soluble up here relative to lower temperature stuff at lower pressures. And this is...
it's in the glass.
Oh! Yeah, this is a black and tan, it's called, where they put like a heavy ale or lager in the bottom, depending on which kind you make. The lager is like a harp. It's made by Guinness Brewing Company. The ale would be like a Bass, which would be from Britain. And then this is Guinness, which is poured very carefully over the top to prevent mixing. But the implication of this is that... I've talked to several of you about this before. I'll just go back to this slide here. Is that if oxygen content of the core is determined by partitioning at the base of a shallower magma ocean, then the core started off with less oxygen in it than it would have if it equilibrated with the bottom of the mantle at CMB conditions. So it's undersaturated. That presents an interesting problem because you have this big silicate magma body possibly here, which would then be free to interact, and you'd think they'd come to equilibrium, right? They don't, because if they did, the core would have something like 40 or 50% light elements instead of 10%. And so one of the things that I've been thinking about is that if you do have a reaction between the two, that actually the stuff that dissolves into the metal at the top of the core is less dense, and it is there a talk at two? Okay, all right, we're out of here. Is that it forms a stable stratification anyways at the top of the core, which prevents mixing and equilibration between the core and the mantle, and that would be the